United States versus Wallace. Mr. Newhall.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jeremiah Newhall for Robert Wallace. And Mr. Wallace's chief objection here is that the government has an available witness, the only available witness, who saw the passenger who was in this car with marijuana and never called the witness, never showed the witness, Trooper Wilson, a photograph of Mr. Wallace. The government's argument that, well, Trooper Wilson is out of state and calling him would be a burden, it doesn't respond to the idea that the government could email or fax a neutral photo array to Trooper Wilson and he could sign an affidavit. That would still allow for the kind of flexible standard that this court and the Supreme Court have endorsed for these proceedings. And yet the government didn't even do that. So when there's evidence that could definitively exculpate Mr. Wallace out there or incriminate him, either way, and the government doesn't bring that definitive evidence, that's error because the evidence they did rely on was unreliable hearsay.
What is status of Jordan's appeal? Because you contend that he also argued for the use of a balancing test.
He did argue that. It was argued, I believe, November 15th, and there's no decision that I'm aware of.
Sort of a slow...
I certainly don't think that's slow, Your Honor.
If the hearsay was reliable, if the court believed it was reliable, is there a need to bring up the officer from Texas?
Well, yes, because I think that even if the court had correctly determined that the hearsay was reliable, it applied the wrong test. And so remand would still be necessary to apply the correct test, which is the balancing test that's been endorsed explicitly in the advisory committee notes.
Didn't the court on the record apply both tests ultimately? Didn't he recognize that he could bring the officer up, but the balance didn't necessitate bringing him up in light of the reliability of the hearsay?
Well, the government's made that argument that the court applied both tests, but I disagree. I read the court's written opinion differently. That's the only place it even arguably could have done it. After it made the decision explicitly that this circuit applies the reliability test under Kelly and the Eighth Circuit cases are not binding on it, it then went on to find that it felt the hearsay evidence was reliable because portions of the report are verified by the videotape, and certainly much of the report is corroborated by the videotape. It's a detailed report, and it matches the videotape, but the videotape doesn't show the passenger at all, so it can't corroborate that.
Did Wallace specifically preserve an objection to the double hearsay in the police report? In other words, could we find that if we searched the record?
He didn't specifically say double hearsay. But he did object to all of the hearsay evidence, which certainly put the court on notice that it needs to look at this hearsay evidence and decide if it's reliable. And part of deciding if a police report is reliable, police reports routinely include statements from other people, is looking at whether those statements are also reliable. And in other cases, for instance, the government has cited repeatedly to, I believe it's Jackson v. Crawford, you know, those were hearsay statements of a victim, and the victim's statements were corroborated by other direct observations by the officer.
The passenger, though, in this case, produced an ID. I'm confused on whether it's a California ID or an Illinois ID, but an identification card with a photograph, but more importantly, with a date of birth on it. Is that correct?
It's correct that it had a photograph on it. We don't know if it had a date of birth on it. We know that Trooper Wilson says in his report that I was able to identify the passenger as Robert Wallace, and gave date of birth and of Springfield, Illinois. But he doesn't actually say that I was able to identify him that way because that's what the ID said.
Well, but the police report that was run, Government Exhibit 3, has a date of birth on it. Looks like from a California identification card.
Right.
If the date of birth of the passenger, the unknown passenger, is run, you come up with a criminal history of your client. And doesn't that mean that was him?
No, it doesn't mean that that was him because criminals routinely use fake IDs. And the Exhibit 3, the criminal history report they're relying on, used a California ID number. There's no legitimate photo ID that Robert Wallace could have had that would depict an adult man in its photograph that would have his name and address and ID number.
Well, the photograph would have been the best evidence or an in-person testimony from someone saying, that's the guy in court. Here in court at the revocation hearing is the guy I saw in the car. But the court could rely upon a variety of other circumstantial pieces of evidence which were detailed. Would that be an abuse of discretion for the court to have made a finding that the passenger was your client?
Yes, it was, because the other circumstantial details verify that Trooper Wilson, for instance, seems to be an accurate observer and an honest guy. They verify what he said. The video, the other corroborative evidence, was chiefly the videotape, doesn't verify that the passenger is an honest person. It shows the passenger is a dishonest person. The passenger rode in a car with fake license plates. Trooper Wilson observed the physical actions of the passenger as being nervous and indicative of criminal activity. Trooper Wilson did not trust this passenger, and the passenger lied about his criminal history. He either lied about being Robert Wallace, or he lied about being arrested 10 years ago for murder, but it was self-defense. Because Robert Wallace was convicted 20 years ago for murder, and he pled guilty. There was no hint of self-defense. The government's saying these things are consistent, but it's not consistent when somebody says, I was arrested for a completely different murder a decade later. That's not a consistent recitation of the criminal history here.
So is the hearsay corroborated by the later arrest of?
Well, I think the district court said in its decision there's two really powerful pieces of evidence, and one it said was the ID, and the other was the situations of his later arrest. And that's some corroboration. I'm not going to argue that it's not somewhat indicative, but Mr. Wallace, in his elocution, gave a credible reason for being in Texas, which was he had received a letter from his attorney. We don't have it in the record, but he explained he'd received a letter from an attorney advising him he'd been indicted in Texas in the interim. And we know that he was indicted in Texas in the interim. And he said he went to face the charges. If there are no questions at this time, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thanks, counsel. Mr. Bass.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, despite our office's competent appellate practice before this Court and its filing of our brief in this case, I wanted to participate in the oral argument today to not only because I think it's important for trial attorneys to participate in appellate practice, but also to assure this Court that the government takes seriously its obligation to present competent, admissible, and reliable evidence at a revocation hearing. Much has been cited in this brief and in the companion Jordan brief of the comment in the Jordan hearing that the government didn't call Trooper Wilson because the rules of evidence did not require it. And I can certainly understand that reading a cold record such as that, that inartful comment may cause this Court, as it did Judge Hamilton in the oral argument, concern about that obligation. But we do take that obligation seriously, and we met that obligation in this case. We obtained the information from Texas through the probation officer. We conferred with Trooper Wilson. We obtained his report, the video evidence, as well as the grand jury indictment, and made a determination that this hearsay evidence was not only reliable, but much of which was conclusively proven. Because if Your Honors haven't viewed the video, I urge you to if you have any question about its reliability, because you can read along with that report while you watch what is documented in that report.
You know, I have no problem in general with the reliability of the police report as evidence of what this officer saw and said, but there is this second layer of hearsay in the identification of Wallace. What admissible evidence is there that Wallace was the passenger in the car during that first stop? I mean, the ID is unreliable hearsay. The statement by Jordan is unreliable hearsay. What else is there?
Your Honor, I'd refer you in detail to pages 39 and 40 of our brief. But again, I would urge Your Honors, if you have a question as to the reliability, to review that video, because the evidence is this. One, the traffic stop video reflects that the driver identified the passenger as Robert. Two, the passenger himself identified himself as from Springfield, Illinois, and produced an ID card. And Your Honor raised the question as to what was the origin of that ID card. Well, we know that the ID card identified the passenger as Robert Wallace from Springfield, Illinois, with an accurate date of birth, and that the trooper then ran the criminal history, and that produced two ID numbers, one a California and another an FBI number.
Where's the ID that was produced by the passenger claiming to be Wallace? I assume it's in your custody?
It's not in our custody, Your Honor, and I don't know whether it remained, if it was returned to Mr. Wallace, because as you know, he fled the area and was not apprehended. So I don't know if Texas authority had custody of that. But just to go on, Your Honor, to answer your question.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The evidence also included that the passenger accurately identified Wallace by name, his address being from Springfield, Illinois, the fact that he had a prior murder conviction. And based on that information, the trooper ran the criminal history information and, as Your Honor pointed out, accurately identified it as him as Robert Wallace. And then a month later, Mr. Wallace and Mr. Jordan are arrested together in the same area. Now, that evidence as a whole, Your Honor, I would suggest to you is not only in part conclusively proven, but is reliable. And whether you characterize it as single hearsay, double hearsay, the question still is the same, whether you apply a balancing test, a just cause test that this court applied in Kelly, or an interest of justice test, which is the language of Rule 32.1. Your Honors don't need to revisit or address all those claims because the answer is the same. Is it reliable hearsay? And I would submit to you it certainly was. And what is the alternative that the defendants are raising now for the first time on appeal? The plausible alternative, as I think Judge Posner wrote in Beard, the plausible alternative is that there was an imposter, that this imposter had the foresight to create a fake ID in Robert Wallace's name in anticipation of possibly being stopped with Keith Jordan. And the two of them together conspired to frame Robert Wallace in advance of this future traffic stop.
But why did the government fail to have the trooper identify Wallace through a photo array? It would have been a very low-cost way to eliminate the uncertainty of the hearsay identification, because now we have this discrepancy about his weight, whether it was the same man. I mean, is there anything on the record that can address that discrepancy? What did Wallace weigh when he was arrested? Would the record tell us that?
Your Honor, the record does not tell you if the government asked through the probation officer to identify, to conclusively identify Robert Wallace. The record doesn't answer that question, and I won't go beyond the record. But, again, based on the evidence that is in the record, video evidence, the fact that Ms. Turner talked with Trooper Wilson herself, obtained this evidence, we made the determination that the evidence was reliable. And we didn't just unilaterally make that determination ourselves. Once this issue was raised, because it wasn't raised by Mr. Jordan, we briefed it to Judge Mills and gave him the opportunity to advise the government whether we were wrong. And the defendant himself had the opportunity to speak with Trooper Wilson, to call him, to suggest that the district court conduct a video conference or even a phone call testimony. None of that was done. This issue about misidentification is only raised for the first time on appeal. Mm-hmm. And if What the defense is asking Your Honors to do in this case is to, in addition to revisit Kelly and apply a balancing test, but to radically apply that balancing test and impose a reasonable doubt standard, require an in-person, in-court identification by the trooper. And I would submit, Your Honors, that due process requires nothing of the kind. The evidence in this case was reliable. You can see it for yourselves in part by the video. And Judge Mills made a finding that it was reliable.
The video does nothing to corroborate the identification, does it?
It does, Your Honor, to this extent, that Mr. Jordan identified the passenger as Robert. The passenger himself produced an ID card in the name of Robert Wallace from Springfield, Illinois. You can hear the passenger say, when he was asked how old he is, 39. Robert Wallace is 39. And he also says that he has a prior murder conviction. And just to complete the thought about the plausible alternative provided by the defense is that through this foresight that there was this conspiracy for this passenger to pose as an imposter in the event that they were stopped, and it just so happened that they were stopped. And I would suggest, Your Honors, that not to overstate it, but that plausible alternative is not plausible, but simply absurd, and certainly does not negate Judge Mills' finding that it was reliable and that it was evidence more likely than not that it was the defendant.
The bottom line is this evidence something you would act on?
Certainly, Your Honor. And we did act, and not in haste. When the issue was raised, we evaluated and we presented it to the court for its determination. And again, if this issue had been raised in the district court as it is now, we may have revisited our conclusion that Trooper Wilson wasn't necessary, or at least presented in the record the fact that we had spoken with him about identification or had him on the phone. But none of this was raised until now. And the fact that it's raised now does not negate the reliability, Your Honor, Judge Rovner, of whether the hearsay, whether you call it single or double hearsay, is reliable. Finally, I want to make one comment about the sentencing argument. While I appreciate the attribution in the reply brief, I don't believe I'm that influential on Judge Mills. The fact is that the statement about the grand jury standard was not accurate. I made that statement as additional proof for the record for this court to know, have some basis to review why it was we didn't produce Trooper Wilson. And in addition to the reasons I've just mentioned, there was also a grand jury indictment for whatever weight the court deemed to give it. But Judge Mills made it clear before that statement was made that he viewed the evidence as easily satisfying the standard and strong. And he further made clear that his reason for imposing a sentence was because of the serious nature of the violation, the reckless nature of it, the fact that it imposed a risk on the lives of others. And it was on that basis that he imposed the maximum sentence. So, Your Honors, for those reasons, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bass.
Thank you.
Mr. Newell?
Yes, Your Honor, I do want to address the argument that there was no plausible alternative. Beard dealt with the burden of proof and arguments about sufficiency of the evidence. Our argument is that this evidence was inadmissible. So once the evidence is taken out, and this is one of the two things that Judge Mills said he found particularly persuasive, was the ID followed by the immediate running of a criminal history check. And we don't have the criminal history check from 3 a.m. November 3rd. It's not in the record. We have one from November 4th at 4 p.m. in the afternoon using a California ID number. There's no record of any criminal history check using an Illinois ID number. The government appears to concede in its brief that a California ID for Mr. Wallace could not possibly have been legitimate. So, and the idea that there could have been no foreplanning for this, that's not a plausible alternative. But there was foreplanning. They were riding in a car with false license plates. They'd already taken some steps to falsify who they were. And were accused of riding in a car with 30 pounds of marijuana. So I don't find it implausible that drug smugglers might take steps to hide their identity or point the finger at someone else. And particularly, as Judge Rovner noted, the description that the government relies on in its brief does not match the description of Robert Wallace from the police report. So if the police report is reliable and Trooper Wilson's observations are reliable, then the criminal history check is wrong or is for someone else. So with that, unless there are no questions.
Thank you, Counsel. Thanks to both counsel.